the Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches.
Hello, my name is Richard Moore. I'm with Lionel Burney.
Hello, Richard.
And Daniel Freib.
Hello, Lionel, Richie.
Hello, chaps.
Hello.
Very good. Very good, Daniel. That one is back. It's back. I remember that joke being cracked on the South Bank in London about 6 or 7 years ago. So it's great to hear that again. Nostalgia. Lots more racing again this week, chaps. Highlight for me, perhaps, Anthony Turgis winning the Dutch Headwind Championships in Saudi Arabia. I don't know if you saw that at the weekend, but the Dutch Headwind Championships were on actually in Holland, but Anthony Turgis paid a sort of tribute to that by
absolutely
into a strong headwind.
We've already had too much kit chat this year, but he was looking like a lemon meringue pie or a flying lemon meringue pie. Absolutely shocking.
Wouldn't last long in a headwind, would it? Lemon meringue pie.
yellow socks with the white. Oh, yeah, not good.
Well, I mean, criminally underrated, isn't he? Maybe he's just wanting to. Well, he's not flying below the radar very successfully by attacking like that into headwind. It was non-spectacular watching that, but there has been some great racing over the last week, and we're going to be talking about that in this week's episode. We're also going to be hearing from at least one rider who has caught our eye in the last week. What do we have coming up, Daniel?
Well, you've just said what we've got.
No,
coming
I just
up.
Hinted
you
at just, it. I hinted at it.
You just enumerated exactly
I'm
what we've got.
I'm just being enigmatic.
Coming up. Well, Richard, we're going to talk about the Volta. I'm not going to give it its full name. Just call it the Volta Valenciana, the Saudi Tour, the Étoile de Bessèges, those races that you mentioned there, the first sort of round of stage racing across Europe and beyond. And we are going to be discussing some of the revelations of a couple of those races. And then in the final part today, we're going to be looking ahead with the peloton, some of the peloton staying in the Arabian Peninsula, Arabian Gulf. Is Oman in the Arabian Gulf? Not quite, I don't think. Anyway, we're going to be talking about the Tour of Oman, a big name rider making his return to action in Oman. And we'll be hearing from his coach.
We will indeed. It's a topsy-turvy world so far with Lotto Soudal winning left, right and centre and riders moving to Cofidis and getting better, which is reverses a trend of recent years. But you've got a news roundup for us, please, Lionel.
Yeah, well, I'll stick to the headlines because we're going to discuss the racing, aren't we, in this week's episode. But as you say, Daniel, the Volta Valenciana concluded and there was plenty of grumbling from Remco about gravel in Spain. Remco Evenepoel lost the leader's jersey to Alexander.
Grousing about gravel.
Grouchy about gravel, grumbling about gravel, griping about gravel, yes.
Grousing, even.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, he's a young rider, so presumably he's right on the vanguard of the, you know, the gravel revolution. Surely young people love gravel more than us oldies. I don't know. Maybe that's a stereotype. I don't know. But anyway, he lost the leader's jersey to Alexander Vlasov of Bora Hansgrohe, who sealed his first GC win as a professional. Bad news for Jumbo-Visma, Bike Exchange and DSM, whose riders all pulled out of the race because of COVID cases. Movistar did also have another couple of COVID cases. Those riders left the race, but the team carried on. Fabio Jakobsen and Dylan Groenewegen, people will remember, were both involved in that terrible finish line crash at the Tour of Poland in 2020. And coincidentally, they won on the same day last week, taking stage wins in Valencia and Saudi Arabia, respectively, and ending the week with two wins each. In the desert, Maxim Van Hiels of Lotto Soudal gave the Belgian team a really important overall victory after winning a spectacular uphill finish. Over in France, Benjamin Thomas was the star of Bessèges for Cofidis, as you say, Richard. There was a women's race in Valencia, which was won by Marta Bastianelli for the new UAE team. And off the bike, Giro champion Egan Bernal is out of hospital. The extent of his injuries has emerged he said on social media that he had broken, at my count, 18 bones in that terrible crash where he hit a bus while training on his time trial bike in Colombia. 11 ribs, his femur, kneecap and 2 vertebrae in his spine. Tadej Pogacar has had COVID, but after isolating, he is still on track to start his season at the UAE Tour. That starts on February the 20th. And as you say, Daniel, the racing carries on. Tour of Oman is starting on Thursday. I'll spoil it by saying that Mark Cavendish is the big name sprinter who is lining up there, as are Arnaud Démare and Fernando Gaviria. The Tour de la Provence is also kicking off on Thursday. Nairo Quintana, Richard Carapaz and the world champion Julian Alaphilippe are set to ride there. But Casper Asgreen of Quickstep is already out of that one. He has got COVID-19. And there's also racing in Spain with the Vuelta Murcia and the Clásica Almería and a new Spanish one-day race which features more gravel. So presumably Remco Evenepoel is giving that a wide berth. Six World Tour teams will ride the Clásica Jaén Paraíso Interior, which is going to feature seven gravel segments and more than 3,000 metres of climbing. And Alejandro Valverde, Tim Wellens, Miguel Angel Lopez and Alexei Lutsenko, who won the Serenissima in Italy, didn't he, last year that you were at, Richard? They're all going to be tackling the gravel.
It will also, chaps, feature a lot of olive trees, I'm guessing. We discussed at length in the Vuelta last year, didn't we? That was the subject of some debate between Joe Dombrowski and myself, what percentage of the world's olive trees were accounted for by the province of Jaén. I think it was between 20 and 25%.
That's right.
Or perhaps the output of olive oil, not the percentage of trees, but the percentage of the world's
olive oil. Come on, let's get this right.
Well, anyway, there'll be plenty of olive oil chat next week when we discuss that one. And before we know it, we'll be into the Ruta del Sol and the Tour of the Algarve next week. And then it will be Omloop Het Nieuwsblad, only a couple of weeks away now, or a bit more than a couple of weeks away. But that's the real start of the season for me, as everyone will know.
Over 60 million trees, 20% of the world's olive oil, supposedly.
Any other news catch your eyes other than olive oil news?
I mean, disappointing not to have any segments this week on team raps or mastermind contestants. Just but a postscript on that is that we made contact with the cycling podcast friend of the podcast, Marty McCann, who took part in Mastermind, actually won the round to progress to the semi-final, and he will feature in a future episode of the cycling podcast. It was great to make contact with him.
I saw some hand-wringing yesterday online about Chris Froome's new clothing line. He's teamed up with a Miami-based designer to produce a line of hoodies and t-shirts. People got in quite a froth about that, having 3 weeks ago or 2 weeks ago completely ignored and not mentioned, not commented on the atrocity. I'm sorry, Chris, the atrocity that was Chris Froome's golf swing. posted a video of Israel Startup Nation. On a brighter note, though, James Pickerley was quite impressive on the range. The World Tour Peloton's answer to Phil Mickelson, a lovely left-hander he is, and a lovely smooth swing. Very impressive.
Speaking of clothing ranges, though, Jan Tratnik put in a bid, I thought, last week for the what are you calling it? The Rolling Cassoulet Award. Unfortunately, didn't quite work out for him, but I thought he was going to be claiming that from Brandon McNulty in down
the
there in
performance of the year, the rolling performance of the year. Yeah, we haven't quite set out the parameters of this, but do you have to win the race in order to claim?
Well, that's
the
a good
prize?
Question.
We'll have to weigh that up as the performances come along. I have to say, it wasn't anything that particularly caught my eye.
Can you produce
week,
a great was, performance without winning?
Yes.
Give
but
me
can
an
you win the Cassoulet Prize without winning?
At the end of this episode, I want examples from each of you, and I'll try and come up with one myself as well, of a great performance where the rider didn't win. Okay? It's a challenge.
The Cycling Podcast, powered by Super Sapiens. Energy management for committed athletes and coaches. And now you can wear the Super Sapiens Energy Band, the first and only wearable that can display real-time glucose data directly from Abbott's LibreSense Glucose Sport Biosensor. The Super Sapiens Energy Band is available at supersapiens.com for €159.
Thank you very much indeed to our title sponsor, Super Sapiens. Very grateful to them for their support across all the cycling podcast shows. And some Super Sapiens news. They've partnered with UCI pro team Aolo Cometa, the Italian squad that's run by Ivan Basso and Alberto Contador. Who could forget lucky Lorenzo Fortunato's stage win on Monte Zoncolan at last year's Giro? Well, this year the team's riders will be working closely with Super Sapiens using Abbott's LibreSense Glucosport Biosensor and the new energy band. Fran Contador, who's Alberto's brother and runs the team, described Super Sapiens as an important partner and said, "They will help us better oversee the fueling and nutrition of our riders, which we believe will directly improve performance." Well, chaps, we went quite big last week, didn't we, on Remco Evenepoel's very eye-catching performance on stage one down there in Valenciana. It looked very good indeed, but faded a little bit over the course of the week as Alexander Vlasov took his first stage race win for Bora Hansgrohe, a really important win for them. We heard from Rolf Aldag a couple of weeks ago about how that team has really changed its focus this year to stage races, and that's a pretty perfect start for them with this new focus and with one of their new riders, Vlasov. But you mentioned, Lionel, the Evenepoel complaining about the gravel. He is taking on some personality traits of his boss, Patrick Lefebvre, I think. You know, Lefebvre a couple of years ago complaining about the dirt roads in Paris-Tours. He's a real traditionalist sometimes, Lefebvre, very conservative sometimes. And Evenepoel, for such a young rider, he's pretty outspoken on some of these things. And I don't think it always does him many favours.
I think, chaps, this is mitigated. We should caveat this by saying that to my knowledge, there were at least four correspondents from Belgian newspapers at the Volta Valenciana, which would not ordinarily happen. It's a pretty small race, and I don't imagine there were any other foreign journalists there. So there is always someone willing to shove a microphone under Remco's nose and solicit his opinions about anything and everything. And I suspect if you did the same to the majority of riders in the peloton, I mean, some of them would still say absolutely nothing that was quote worthy, but a lot would. And I think that's what's happening here mainly.
Yeah, I mean, he did reference the gravel section, as we heard in last week's podcast, when Quickstep had a little media thing the day before the race, and he made the point that when they went on their recon, they didn't even go any further because they assumed that the GPX file that they were following was in some way inaccurate. The inference being that they couldn't believe the race was going to take on this gravelly, rocky section. And he did quip that it would be a beautiful stage for mountain bikes. And I think there's a little glint in the eye when he says these things. I mean, at the end of the day, he's come undone on a steep, difficult finish. But, I mean, it was still a good week for Evenepoel. I mean, the manner in which he won the stage he won was really impressive, as we said last week, and the couple of big turns to lead out Fabio Jakobsen, set up Fabio Jakobsen as part of a very impressive Quick-Step team for the sprints. I mean, they did everything. They controlled all day. They led it out. Evenepoel did some huge turns on those run-ins, stage four, which was eventually won by Moschetti of Trek, Segafredo, and stage five, which Jakobsen won. That was his second stage win of the race. So, I mean, I think there's a little pinch of salt to take from those quotes. I'm with you there, Daniel. But on the flip side of that, it's up to the race organisers to make a compelling event. And that stage with the gravel was a really good watch. So, you know, the organisers are going to find these roads and they're going to make these stages, and the riders are going to have to do them. And the bike manufacturers want to showcase the gravel bikes that they've got. And I think, you know, there's a bigger ecosystem at play than just whether or not individual riders think they should or shouldn't have to ride these sort of stages or these sorts of sections.
It was pretty extreme and pretty hard. That's one of the most compelling aspects of sections like this. So in a way, it reminded me of the new Super La Planche des Belles Filles finish that goes onto the dirt roads and just seems to carry on forever. You see the riders in those situations working in a way that you don't often see them working and suffering. And, you know, riders can lose a lot of time in a very short distance, as happened with Evenepoel. It is spectacular. And I think that if you're going to include sections as extreme as that in any race, then I think it's fine to include them in a race like Valenciana, where there's not as much at stake as there is in some other races. It's definitely the way the sport is going. And Evenepoel, I mean, I was surprised to see him come unstuck there in the way that he did, but it was really hard. He wasn't the only rider to suffer. I guess, as you say, Lionel, the other story from that race was the Quick-Step sprinting machine. They've actually just released a video today showing some of their work on sprints. We're going to hear, as you said earlier, Daniel, from Cavendish's coach. He also coaches Fabio Jakobsen, doesn't he, a bit later on. But their sprint leadouts were firing very well. And we've got the intriguing prospect of, as I think I mentioned a while ago, Groenewegen and Jakobsen establishing themselves as the two best sprinters in the world. And you've made the point before, Daniel, that prior to their terrible crash in Poland, that was the trajectory they were both kind of on. And it was, for both riders, it was kind of held up and potentially stopped after that crash. You know, they both suffered injuries. Jakobsen's obviously far worse, but I think for Groenewegen, there was the trauma also of having been involved in the crash, broken collarbone and a suspension that he had to deal with. But we said that his move to Team Bike Exchange was a masterstroke for Bike Exchange. I think already it looks as if that may well be the case. It's given them a focal point that they've certainly lacked.
Yeah, I think we saw at the Vuelta, didn't we, last year, they were really sort of struggling for more to give their race a kind of a raison d'etre, and they were sometimes working for Michael Matthews as though Matthews was a frontline sprinter, which he's not necessarily these days. He's more versatile than that and a different kind of rider. But I expect Groenewegen to have a really good season, and it will be interesting when they come up against each other. Just with Jakobsen as well, you know, we think that Patrick Lefebvre has pretty much said that he's the sort of first choice, the frontline sprinter, the guy who's earmarked for the Tour de France. But it's going to be, it just struck me watching him win there and watching the sort of celebrations afterwards, it's going to be a different emotional sort of experience for that team and that sort of sprint train. It's going to be, you know, Cavendish brings a certain aura and a certain energy to proceedings, which is different from what Jakobsen does. And, you know, that the sort of fire and ice worked perfectly with Morco because we know that he's a very calm character. And it's just going to be interesting to see that, how that works and how Cavendish goes, which we'll talk about later. The another thing that caught my eye, chaps, while we should talk about Vlasov really as well in light of, you know, what we heard a few weeks ago about Bora Hansgrohe's focus on stage races this year. And Vlasov is their guy for the Tour de France, but he was very, very impressive. And on that gravel, particularly, Rich, he was extremely impressive. And also Carlos Rodriguez of Ineos, you know, has been obviously a lot of concern about Egan Bernal, the Ineos, their main GC guy over the last couple of weeks. But Rodriguez is someone who's not really, he's not really attracted the same attention as some other young riders over the past two or three years, mainly because he's been building pretty slowly and being nurtured pretty slowly. And even, you know, we've been talking about Juan Ayuso in the last couple of weeks, this other very young Spanish sort of phenom at UAE. I thought he might even sort of blow everyone's doors off at the Volta Valenciana. But it was Rodriguez who was the more impressive. And yeah, those two have had a rivalry going back years to their junior days, and both, you know, very good climbers, time trialists. Ayuso was a little bit quicker, but it's going to be really interesting to see what Ineos do with him over the next few months.
Yeah, Rodriguez is an interesting one. I think he's also flown below the radar, weirdly, being on that team, Ineos, because there are so many riders that sort of soak up all the attention that he's been allowed to develop quite quietly, but some very encouraging results for him, second at the Tour de l'Avenir last year as well. You know, could he emerge as somebody who, because we hear reports that the program, certainly Matteo Tosato, the sports director at Ineos, has suggested that that they're not going to tinker with their planned lineups for the Grand Tours this year, that Carapaz, we assumed in Bernal's absence, Carapaz would go to the Tour de France instead of the Giro. But according to Tozzato, the plan is at the moment still for Carapaz to lead the team into the Giro, which potentially, with Richie Porte, Tao Geoghegan-Hart and Carapaz all going to the Giro, could leave them a bit light at the Tour. Geraint Thomas obviously will be planning to go there, but could a rider like Carlos Rodriguez, could this be an opportunity for him to step up and be a, I don't know, a protected rider, or certainly an interesting option for them at the Tour de France?
I think he's being sort of groomed for the Vuelta at the moment. They had in mind to put him in the Vuelta. I mean, the issue, there is going to be an issue throughout this season, as we thought there would be last year, or we're certainly going to talk about it, I'm sure, the balance that Ineos have to strike between giving opportunities and keeping people happy. Even with Bernal, you know, out of the equation, certainly for the first half of the year, you know, you've got guys like Sivakov and Tao Geoghegan-Hart who are at key, you would think they're at a key stage now. They're at a bit of a fork in the road in terms of whether they are going to be GC leaders on that team. And I guess there'll be some quite difficult decisions that the team has to make at certain points this year, with Adam Yates as well.
Just on Vlasov, because that was his first GC victory as a pro rider, and it feels like quite a long time in the making, that victory. Think back to his Gazprom days when he first caught the eye, and then a few years with Astana, and obviously some really high profile results in both stage races and one day races. Obviously the biggest results he's had so far, fourth in last year's Giro d'Italia and second in Paris-Nice last year. But that was his first victory, and I wonder if that's sort of broken the seal for him, get him over the line and actually win a stage race. It could be the first of a handful this season. You get the feeling that he is moving up a level this year. The other things that caught my eye...
Well, it capped a fantastic week for Vlasov, because not only did he win his first stage race for his new team, but he will also have realised that by leaving Astana when he did, he avoided being part of the Astana rap. A great week for Vlasov.
Well,
certainly.
And he avoided being sent up the road in the final day punishment break, as Manuele Boaro and Vincenzo Nibali did. I was surprised to see them up the road in a four-man break. It was a pretty powerful break, wasn't it? But I wondered what Nibali was actually doing there. Just, I guess, training, really. Looking forward to bigger objectives later on, and having a tougher day out than he would ordinarily have done, just sort of rolling along in the bunch. But it was a good race, wasn't it? And I enjoyed the gravel section, and I think, I'm not gonna side with riders grumbling. It's a bit like golfers, I suppose, complaining about the wind or the pin positions or the length of the holes or whatever it is golfers complain about. I don't know, what else do they complain about, Daniel? Taxes, I suppose, most of them.
the quality.
I think they must complain about the clothes they have to wear, don't they?
Oh, they certainly should, yeah. Maybe about people like Chris Froome debasing their sport by posting clips on social media. Absolute eyesores.
I mean, you're being harsh there, but I want to see Phil Mickelson riding Alpe d'Huez now. I think it's only fair.
Talking of courses, chaps, I guess it's time to move on to the Saudi Tour. And before we say anything about the racing, we were pretty, well, we sort of raised a collective eyebrow last week at, you know, the whole notion of a race taking place in Saudi Arabia. And we talked about the efforts that country is going to promote itself through sport. But if we're to take politics out of the equation for a minute, I must say that I found it probably the most visually appealing, interesting races we've seen in that part of the world, in the Gulf, of the various races that have come and gone and stayed over the years, including Oman and Qatar and UAE, Dubai Tour and so forth. There were a couple of stages which were a real feast for the eyes. And I suppose, you know, if one was to imagine a sort of global sport, professional cycling, and what it should be doing, again, taking politics out of our thoughts and considerations, showcasing as many sort of different landscapes and different parts of the world as possible in the manner that the Saudi Tour did very successfully would be part of that brief, I would suggest.
I agree, yeah. It looked spectacular. It's very different type of place to Qatar, for example, where you know we sort of grew to love the racing in Qatar in a weird way with the crosswinds that you often had there, but the desert there is pretty ugly and pretty featureless, and there's a lot of industry, whereas in Saudi Arabia, certainly the parts that we were taken to through the race, there were a lot of very spectacular vistas, and you know the stage where Maxime Van Hiels really laid the groundwork for his overall win when he got away with Andrea Baggioli, dropped him on that climb. Again, it was a really fascinating finish to the race. A tough climb, and an enjoyable race to watch from the comfort of your home.
Yeah, certainly potential from the visual point of view and the potential for crosswinds as well, and a good workout for the sprinters. And we're in that phase of the season, aren't we, very early days, where all the sprinters seem to be dotted around in different places, so they all look sort of equally impressive. But I did think Dylan Groenewegen, he's got off to a great start with his new team, Bike Exchange, hasn't he? Two stage wins there. And Caleb Ewan, unfortunate on the final day to have an ill-timed puncture as the race was really hotting up towards the end, but will no doubt take heart from the fact that he won the difficult finish on the opening day. But overall, it was a very competitive week's racing. And I thought the uphill finish where Baggioli and Van Hiels went clear together and Van Hiels attacked and got away and won the stage, and that was the performance that set up his overall victory. I mean, that was spectacular, dramatic, and a very exciting culmination to the second of the difficult finishes.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting three matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the Crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.
Well, the other race that was going on last week down in the south of France, a race that is we're more familiar with, it's been around forever, Étoile de Bessèges. And it represented a triumph for Cofidis with a couple of stage wins for new riders for them, kind of old names to us. Benjamin Thomas has joined from Groupama FDJ, and Brian Coquart, Le Coq, as he's known on French TV, joining from B&B Hotels. After a few pretty disappointing years for Brian Coquart, there was a time when he was a great kind of hope of French cycling and sprinting. Both very accomplished track riders, Thomas and Coquart. And Coquart won a difficult stage up against Mads Pedersen on an uphill finish, a really hard stage. And Thomas took the overall, taking a stage win and then holding on in the time trial. He's the French national time trial champion. So a real turn up for the books and a really important win that for Cofidis. The Uno X team were very impressive. They've been very public about wanting a wild card for the Tour de France. Will they have furthered their cause, or is it really too late? Has that already been decided? We're not sure. They were also pretty prominent in Saudi Arabia as well, weren't they? They've been very visible already this year. But Étoile de Bessèges did throw up a few surprises. One non-surprise was Filippo Ganna winning the time trial at the end. But it was an entertaining race. And Lionel, you spoke to a young Norwegian who certainly caught her eye there.
Yeah, it was stage four that Tobias Halland Johannesson won to Mon Bouquet, which is just where Ben O'Connor won a stage of the same race a couple of years ago. And, well, the name Johannessen may well have lodged in people's minds because he won the Tour de l'Avenir last year for the Norwegian national team. And it just made me think that the Tour de l'Avenir has become a really key indicator of future success, certainly in terms of the roll call of winners in recent years. In 2019, Tobias Foss won. Before that, Tadej Pogacar, Egan Bernal, David Gaudu, Marc Soler, Miguel Angel Lopez, Ruben Fernandez, Warren Barguil, Esteban Chavez, Nairo Quintana. I mean, there is not a rider there who hasn't gone on to make a pretty impressive professional career for themselves. Grand Tour champions in there as well. Johannessen also had a very good ride at the Giro, well, as we call it, the baby Giro, the Giro d'Italia for under 23 riders, where he finished second to Juan Ayuso. And I suppose just continuing the theme of young riders, because I've been a bit sniffy in the past, haven't I, about young riders. They're like buses. There'll be another one along soon enough. But we're certainly in the era of the young phenomenon, I think, aren't we? Not just seeing the way that the likes of Pogacar and co have adapted to the pro ranks so quickly. But even when you look at the baby Giro recent winners, 2020 Tom Pidcock, 2018 Alexander Vlasov, 2017 Pavel Sivakov, these races are now really throwing up the stars of the future in, you know, very short order, aren't they? So I thought I'd speak to Johannessen. I got him on the phone after he had travelled back to his home near Oslo in Norway after winning a stage at the Étoile de Bessège and finishing third overall.
The first three stages was really good for our team, but we didn't like completely make it with our tactics. So for the fourth stage, which suited me quite well, we went all in from the start. And in the finishing climb, I knew that I could win the stage. So from the bottom, all I could think about was going to finish off with a win. So yeah, the pace was quite hard from the start. And Jay Wine from Alpecin Phoenix made an attack like halfway up the climb. And then I decided to just follow and try to work with him. And I know that after a hard climb, I can still sprint quite well. So my tactic was just to try to hold the wheels and then try to take it in the end. And yeah, I got some legs to finish it off with a sprint. So I was really happy to give back to the team after a brilliant week of teamwork. So yeah, that was fun.
I mean, it was third time lucky, I guess, but the two previous days, you were in the break with a former world champion, Mads Pedersen, and you were in the finish with former Tour of Flanders winner, Alberto Bettiol. I mean, quite an interesting way to begin your career as a professional in the pro ranks.
Yeah, that was quite unexpected, but yeah, it's like, you know, we always like to try to make the race, and yeah, that was no different from any other race. So we just went all in.
And then the race finished off with a time trial. Now, I did read something that said it was only the third time trial you've ever done, but that can't be right, surely?
Yeah, I think that's right. my twin brother and I have been mountain bikers until 2020. So there has been zero focus on aero gains and stuff like that. But we had one prologue in Tour de l'Avenir, and I also did one time trial in the under 23 Giro. So that was my third race on a time trial bike. So, but I think it's a fun way of racing.
Wow. I mean, a good performance, because you held on to a place on the podium by just a couple of seconds.
Yeah, that was quite close, but yeah, I'm really happy that it was a couple of seconds in my favor. So yeah, that was a nice bonus for the week.
You mentioned your twin brother there, Anders, I think is his name, is that correct? But who got into cycling first, and how did you get interested in cycling?
I think growing up in a small town here in Drøbak, we always have had to use our bikes to get to school and stuff like that. So it was just like a natural thing. And when we are twins, we always like to compete. So like when we were riding back home from school, it was always a sprint into the gate of the house. So it was just a natural thing for us to start to race bikes.
And who was the best at sprinting back to the house? Who won the most sprints?
I think we're quite like 50-50 on that one, and we're still counting. So every training ride is the same. Still a sprint.
Well, you've certainly got off to a good start this year. He's got some catching up to do. What about cycling in Norway? Because you would have been growing up in the era of maybe you're a little young for to remember Tor Hushov in his greatest days, but certainly Alexander Kristoff, Edvald Bosenhagen. I mean, what do these figures mean for a young person growing up in Norway getting into cycling?
I think it means a lot because we're quite small in like the cycling world, but there has almost every year there has been some top results from Norwegian cyclists. So yeah, we have always seen that it's been a possibility to ride bikes as a pro, and I think the UNOX program now is also, there's a lot of guys there that has been looking up to Tor Hushovd and Edvald Bosenhagen and Alexander Kristoff, so now we're trying to be the next ones.
I mean, what's it like being on a team which is predominantly Norwegian riders? I mean, after the results you had last year, there must have been some other interest in you. So was that the case? And what made you choose Uno X?
I think I feel like it's a really safe environment. And both my twin brother and me are still quite new. So there's a lot to learn. And also, we have had our coach for, I think, 4 years now, who has been working with the UNOX system for a long time. So it's, yeah, it feels like home. And I think we're also like developing in the same pace. So UNOX wants to be World Tour and we want to be World Tour riders one day. And I think that dream can come true together. So, to be a part of a team like this from Norway is like, it's never happened before, so I would just feel lucky to be in this team.
About the baby Giro, the under-23 Giro last year, because you were second on the podium behind Juan Ayuso, who a lot of people are quite excited about, a very good climber. I mean, what was that race like for you, and what did you learn from that kind of result?
I think, that was a really fun race. I really enjoyed racing in Italy as well. So it was my first like real stage race. So I learned like the structure of how you could perform in a stage race and how important fueling and everything is. So I brought a lot of that into Tour de l'Avenir later in the season. So that was a nice race.
Yeah, tell me about the Tour de l'Avenir, because you went up against the Italian rider Filippo Zanna, didn't you? Again, you basically won the two toughest stages right at the end of the race.
Yeah, it was that was also a really nice experience, and I had a really good team around me, and we had some good results in the start with Søren Værenskål doing some sprints and PTs, and it was just like 10 days of pure fun racing. So and we had a little scare in the end with Carlos Rodriguez almost taking the win, but in the end our team saved it. So that was probably one of my best memories from last year. So
I mean, just judging from the results there, winning on the Grand Colombier, a race that went deep into the French Alps, you're obviously a climber. That's the type of rider you are.
I really enjoy riding uphill, but I think it's still early to see. I think I will always be a climber, but I also like punchy stages with that ends up in a reduced bunch sprint. So I'm still trying to figure out what type of rider I want to be. But I think that's nice with cycling. There's a lot of different races and different ways of winning. So. Yeah, that's something I will learn more about in the future, I think.
And lastly, I mean, your team must have been delighted with the stage win and the place on the podium. Has that changed the way that you will approach the coming races? Are you going to change your race program? And tell me what your next appearances will be.
I think it doesn't change much. And that's because, like I said before, UNOX always wants to ride aggressively and animate the races. So we're going to do the same thing throughout the year. So I think now for me, I want to learn a bit more about every aspect of cycling. So I think the next for me will be the opening weekend in Belgium and try some cobbled races and that part of cycling as well.
And just very lastly, I mean, Carlos Rodriguez had a really good week in Valencia. I mean, you probably wouldn't have seen too much of that. You're a little bit busy yourself racing. But I mean, it must give you tremendous confidence to know that, you know, last year you were going head to head with him and, you know, he's gone into another pro race with a very strong field and he's slotted right in. So it must give you confidence of where your level is going to be.
Yeah, for sure. It's cool to see the guys that I've been racing in the U23s with do perform good in elite races. And yeah, I think that's a bit of the part of the change in cycling, that it's possible to do good results earlier in the career. So yeah, I think it's going to be an exciting season with a lot of new guys trying to win races. And yeah, I think it's going to be fun.
Well, Lionel, he sounds like a great talker as well as obviously a great bike rider. It showed the kind of great race craft, canniness or shrewdness in a situation with Alberto Bettiol, or perhaps it was a bit self-defeating because Benjamin Thomas was up the road. He was behind with Bettiol. Had they both cooperated and chased, maybe they would have caught him, but he sat on Bettiol for a bit and then jumped him, and that kind of ruined the move. But I thought it was surprisingly bold move by such a young rider against such an established rider. I thought he did very well in asking him about Norwegian cycling influences, not to mention Dag Otto Lauritzen. That showed good awareness of just how young he actually is. Well done.
Dag Otto Lauritzen must have retired about 7 years before he was born.
Dag Otto Lauritzen was already probably around about 55.
He's also now, yeah, Dag so is also good. Now one of the most famous TV personalities in Norway, so we definitely know who Dag is. Dag has his own sort of challenge. If you remember Annika Rice, Challenge Annika on UK television.
I mean, they don't look dissimilar. Do they?
Well, Dag he drives around famously at the tour in the Dag Otto mobile, doesn't he? A branded car with his huge face on the side. I don't mean he's got a huge face. I mean, it's just a huge depiction of his face.
Yeah, it's a big brown face. I mean, he's perma-tanned, looks about 35 still, looks fantastic. Anyway,
he's fantastic. He's fantastic.
He's a very friendly
I see him and socialise
well.
With him on tour every year, and he's a fine gentleman.
Tobias, so one of identical twins, both of whom seem to be very talented, but Tobias certainly is a bit ahead in terms of results at the moment, and yeah, looks a great prospect.
Well, just on the Norwegians and the influences, chaps, we touched on it there, and you know, it's a country that's building quite a heritage now, and well, we see also the presence of the Norwegian fans, or we certainly did before COVID, at the side of the road, and they're one of the countries that's sort of most strongly represented in terms of support. But until now, as far as riders are concerned, it's been quite one-dimensional in the sense there's been a sort of template of a Norwegian rider, hasn't there? They've tended to be tall, pretty heavy, pretty beefy, and sort of hard roadman sprinters, not pure sprinters, but Hushovd and Kristoff certainly quite similar. And that has been the identity of Norwegian rider, but Johannessen could represent sort of coming the emergence of a new breed. And Lionel, I've been talking to Norwegians this week. I spoke to our colleague from Norwegian television, TV2, Magnus Ore, who covers the Tour de France and lots of other races. And I spoke to him about precisely this, why Norway has thus far not produced climbers, Grand Tour riders, and indeed riders that, like Johannessen, appears to be?
That's the million-dollar question. And I think the consensus on that one is that there are not that many races in the youth categories in Norway. And the few that are do not include any sort of climbs or mountains. Because even though we've got mountains all over the place, a lot of the cycling races are centered in the eastern part of Norway, where it's pretty flat.
Okay.
And the guys we had before, like Knut Knutsen in the 80s and Tor Husov, they've all been like classic riders and sprinters. So never really been a big emphasis on developing climbers, but that's changed now the last 5-6 years. So there's a lot of climbers coming through, actually.
Tell me a little bit about this place where he's from, Drøbak.
Yeah, he's from Drøbak, a small place just outside Oslo. So they've been, it's the same place as Karl-Fredrik Hagen, basically, just up the road. Katrine Aalerud from Movistar, just down the road. So it's a lot of riders from that small region. But totally flat, no mountains anywhere to be seen. So it's all about the physiology for those guys, I think.
And you told me that you'd had some contact with these brothers.
Yeah, I mean, like for the last 12 months, we've done quite a few pieces on them. And the interesting thing is that obviously they're identical. You can't really tell who's who from pictures. They actually struggle themselves to say, oh, that's me and that's you. But Tobias actually has like a small mole on his left cheek, I think. So you can actually tell from that. But they're also, you know, they test identical, right, in terms of FTP and VO2 max. They're like identical riders. Tobias has won a lot more races though. But I suspect that Anders will get to that level pretty soon as well. So very down-to-earth, classic Norwegian guys, I would say. And obviously, there was a lot of interest in them from overseas after the Baby Giro and Lavenir last year. But they renegotiated their deal with UnoX and are staying till, I think, 2024?
Yeah. Magnus, obviously, Tobias Foss had a bit of a breakthrough last year. And then, you know, we've got this sort of exciting development with what happened at the Etoile de Bessèges and the Johannessen brothers. Are there any other names that we should be looking out for as far as young Norwegians are concerned over the next few months?
Absolutely. Andreas Leknesund at DSM. Super talent, super prospect. Had a tough... I don't know, tough is the right word, but he didn't really get his big breakthrough last year, his first year with DSM. He's kind of changed his perspectives a little bit. Like, first it was GC oriented, then it was classics, and now he's back to being like a GC focused rider. Top prospect, described as the biggest Norwegian cycling talent ever by former national coach Stig Kristiansen. So he's up there with Tobias Foss and Tobias Halland Johannessen
and
Anders Halland Johannessen.
Yeah. And he's an interesting story because he's from Tromsø and, you know, right in the north.
Yeah, we don't have many.
Leknesund.
Yeah, we don't have many riders from up north. So he's got a unique story. Hopefully it clicks from this year. Like
someone who I guess has spent a lot of his life on a turbo trainer. Or he spent 6 months of every year on the turbo trainer, I would guess. I'm not sure.
Like every Norwegian rider. Mm. So he's had a different upbringing. But he's a super talented guy who might just explode this year or next year. So we got a few GC riders who are developing now. So big change from the classic sprinters types of Christoph, Boasenhagen, Husod, in the past few decades.
So Charles, there we have it. It's not just the Johannessen twins that we should be looking out for, if we can tell them apart. I mean, extraordinary. They can't even tell themselves apart. Imagine looking at a photo and not being quite sure whether it was you or not. That was just a unique experience, isn't it? I wonder if the Yates brothers have that. Probably not.
We obviously just got used to Adam being a different team to his brother and figured that one out. Now along come the Johannessen twins, and sounds like they're going to be difficult to separate. It'll be intriguing to see how Anders gets on when his season starts, which I think is later this week.
And Magnus mentioned there Leknesund, Andres Leknesund, who is probably the northernmost in terms of birth rider in the Pro Peloton, hailing from Tromsø, right? Which often features, in fact, in the Arctic Race of Norway, so above the Arctic Circle.
Which you have attended, haven't you, Daniel?
Yes, and the route was announced, I think, last week, and it's going to be the first edition that's going to take place, I think, entirely below the Arctic Circle. So it's a bit of a sort of violation of the Trade Descriptions Act. But just finally, on the Norwegians, and we mentioned Uno X and their designs on a place at the Tour de France this year. It's a sort of Norwegian Danish team. There's a lot of support among certainly fans of professional cycling for that team and their wild card and ambitions. A lot of people think they would deserve a wild card, but I think it's still, and they're still an outside bet. B&B, the French team that have B&B hotels that have got wild cards in the past couple of years, they're still sort of favourites to take what would be the last one. When will the announcement be made? We're not quite sure, although last year it was on the 4th of February that ASO announced wildcard entries, not only for the Tour but Paris-Nice and the Dauphiné. I spoke to someone at B&B Hotels this morning. They're not sure either, but it could come at any time. Just finally, chaps, do you know what Uno X do?
Oh,
the company.
That's a real... No.
They are fully automated, I believe, petrol stations.
Interesting. Well, they're a team that has generated a lot of goodwill already, I think. Just that they're a fresh new team. We had Orla's interview with Eleanor Barker. They've got a Women's World Tour team this year. And of course, they in year one, they proved to be excellent employers when Eleanor Barker told them that she was unexpectedly expecting a baby, and they're obviously supporting her through that, which is fantastic. There's a lot of goodwill already towards this team, and they've started the season racing very impressively and aggressively wherever they've been. But, you know, the fact that we're expecting the announcement of wildcards around now, or wouldn't be surprised if it came imminently, suggests that the decision on that will have been made several weeks ago. It won't have been made on the basis of how the teams have got on at Étoile des Bessèges, you know. And we don't really know, perhaps even less with the Tour than with the Giro, what the criteria are for selection. There isn't a great deal of transparency around that process, is there?
Well, no, there's no set criteria, is there? It's whether or not the team adds something to the race. And remember, the Grand Départ is in Scandinavia this year. It's in Copenhagen in Denmark. Uno X is a Norwegian team, mostly Norwegian roster, but they do have six Danish riders on the team as well. So that might be enough to persuade ASO to give them an invite, especially when, you know, there is scope to have a few wild cards because there's only 18 World Tour teams, isn't there?
The Cycling Podcast is supported by Science in Sport. Science in Sport, fueled by science.
Thank you very much indeed to Science in Sport for their support of the Cycling Podcast. If you would like 25% off all your Science in Sport products, go to scienceinsport.com and at the checkout, enter the discount code SISCP25. If you take advantage of that discount and use that code, you are supporting the Cycling Podcast as well. So thank you very much. I was saved by an energy gel today while on a ride and started to get really hungry, and it just got me home. So that was good.
Excellent. In other important news, Rich, has the postman delivered to you there in rural northern France?
Yes, I received my MAP consignment. We are partnering with MAP this year. There's a TCP MAP collaboration coming down the tracks. More details than that soon. But I took delivery of their deep winter range jacket tights. You described the clothing as like a second skin, Lionel. I would describe the tights as like a first skin. Mm. I mean, the tights are remarkably comfortable and warm, and they've got padding in them, so you don't have to wear them with shorts that wrinkle up underneath, which is nice. So I've really been enjoying wearing the clothing, and it's been very cold, so it's been keeping me nice and warm.
And it won't be long before we can reveal the extent of our collaboration with MAP. There's some exciting news to announce, maybe a little later this month or perhaps early in March. Next week, chaps, I'm not around on Tuesday or Wednesday. I'm going on a little solo bikepacking trip, riding to somewhere and then riding back home again over a couple of days. My final kind of training, just a sort of dry run before the Tour de Corse a little bit later this spring. And I'll be fueling up with Science in Sport, of course, and very much looking forward to wearing my MAP deep winter jacket as well, Rich. I'll take some pictures of myself.
You're very mysterious. You know, do you know where you're going, or is it just going to be, are you just going to set out right into the wind like Anthony Turgis and then make it a very short ride home the next day?
No, I've got an idea in mind, but
Southwold.
Can't reveal that. No, I've done that before. Can't reveal done that before, at this stage, but I'll mention it next week.
Oh, interesting. Okay. Well, we look forward to hearing about that. What else have we got this week, fellas? We're looking ahead to the Tour of Oman is coming up, and the first appearance of the season by Mark Cavendish. Daniel, what can we expect from Mark Cavendish?
Well, it's a good question, Rich. We haven't heard an awful lot from Mark Cavendish this winter, have we? We've heard a lot from, or as always, we heard a fair bit from Patrick Lefebvre, his team manager, about the team's plans. And we referred earlier in the pod, didn't we, to the, well, what people imagine to be the pecking order. And Fabio Jakobsen has sort of strongly suggested that he's in line to do the Tour de France as the team's main sprinter. But of course, we all remember that last year, Mark Cavendish wasn't supposed to, or it wasn't even on our radar or anyone else's that he might possibly do the Tour de France at this time last year. I mean, most people didn't think he would even be competitive in February last year. And he went on to win 4 stages of the Tour de France. And actually, we didn't mention this earlier, but did you see that he was nominated by in the Laureus Sports Awards, which is kind of an Oscars for sport. He was nominated for the comeback of the year last week. I'm not sure when the awards ceremony is. So anyway, Rich, in answer to your question, I'm not entirely sure what we should expect from Mark, but I'm certainly curious, Rich. And indeed, earlier today, I spoke to Mark's coach at Quickstep Alpha Vinyl, Vasilis Anastopoulos, about exactly what we should expect from Mark this week at the Tour of Oman.
You know, last year was the first time that we started working together. So it was a bit of, you know, a journey to the unknown, as you can say it. This year, we knew exactly what we had to do. So we already worked a whole year together. So I know how Mark responds to the train load and, you know, to the whole plan that we have. So even though he started a bit later than the other guys and had a really busy program, everything seems to be well. So he did a short camp in December. Then he did a longer one in January, starting Calpe and then going to Algarve. So I think he's ready to go. He's ready to go, I think, now. So last days in Algarve, we did some sprints. And, you know, his power values were close to the ones he had last year at the same time. So I'm optimistic that he can start well in Oman. Of course, the biggest targets is, you know, later on UAE, Tirreno. But I think Oman would be a good start.
Because last year, Vasi, it was all, as you say, new. It was new for him to be working with you. He obviously was attempting this incredible comeback. And I guess there was, well, I mean, I know from speaking to him, there was a lot of excitement. He couldn't quite believe what was happening. Well, a new old team, a team that he was going back to. And sort of emotionally, it was an intense experience. Do you get the sense that he's excited about this year?
Yeah, for sure. You know, Mark is a big champion. He likes to win. And the one he starts winning, he just wants to keep winning. So the excitement is the same this year, the same last year. And, you know, we haven't put any specific targets for this year. We just say, okay, we need to start performing as best as possible to every single race. So every single race is going to do, the target is to win. And, you know, it doesn't matter if it's going to be just a one-day race in Belgium or the biggest stage race, you know. He's just a winner, and that's what he wants to do. And this is why we're here for. Just start winning races. And then we'll see how far we can go this year. Of course, he's a year older, but I can tell you that the data we have in our hands shows that he's as strong as last year, at least.
You mentioned there that he's a year older, Vasi. At this age, 35, 36, do you have to do anything as his coach to take that into account? Is he doing sort of, I don't know, is it doing 10% more in the gym that he was this time last year, or 10% more of a certain type of effort, or how do you take that into account, the age factor?
No, you know, so far I haven't seen this as a limiting factor because don't forget that he almost lost 3 years. So, you know, the approach we continue this year is based on the work that we did last year. So we just extend the work that we did last year. And since we saw that it's working with him, his body is responding, then we just keep it like that. I deal with Mark as if he's like 28, 30 years old. To me, he doesn't show any signs of fatigue or he doesn't get any slower, you know, with the age. And that's a huge surprise, to be honest.
I know that Mark hasn't sort of publicly, he hasn't wanted to talk really much about his race program beyond Tirreno. I mean, is it clear in your head what he's going to do in sort of May, June, July, or and what?
So far our target, the first period will go till Tirreno. After Tirreno, we'll sit down and then we'll define the next goals. But so far, we're interested about Oman, UAE, and then Tirreno. Then it's going to do probably the Giro. But then that needs to be confirmed, and then we need to clarify things after Tirreno.
And Vasi, you've got a long relationship, a long association with Fabio Jakobsen as well. I mean, how pleased, how impressed were you with his sprints in Valencia, especially the first one he won by a huge margin?
To be honest, I wasn't surprised at all because we have been working with Fabio last year. You know, we were there with the camps, we did some tests. And Fabio saw that he's up to his game again. He's up to his best. So the numbers he was producing during the camp were really, really good. So I was confident that if everything goes well, he can sprint, he can beat. To me, Fabio now is one of the best sprinters in the world. And he saw that also in Valencia. You know, the only stage that he didn't win, he was boxed. That's why he didn't win. He couldn't sprint. But if he has a good lead-out train, then I don't think there are many sprinters that want that can beat him.
Well, that was Vasilis Anastopoulos, chaps. So much easier to call him Vasi. And, I mentioned there that this time last year, we certainly didn't expect Mark Cavendish to be winning stages at the Tour de France. Last spring, in fact, we discovered later that part of the sort of groundwork that Mark did for his Tour de France was in Greece. And Vasi told me a curious little anecdote today about one of the training sessions that he did at the Olympic Velodrome in Athens. And I think the Greek Minister of Sports happened to be there that day, and he met Mark. And Mark said to him, well, I've enjoyed training so much on these roads in Greece that you really should organise a race here. It's a bit of a travesty that there isn't a major race here. And, this conversation led to lots of other conversations. And, in April this year, on 27th of April, in fact, the Tour of Hellas, the Tour of Greece, will take place. The inaugural edition, certainly this iteration of the Tour of Greece. And Vasilis Anastopoulos, Mark's coach, is heavily involved in that. And Cavendish himself is one of the ambassadors. And there are going to be some World Tour teams there. It's going to start in Crete and then go over to the mainland. Could be a bit of a tune-up for the Giro, or we might see some Tour de France riders there. But that's what we talked earlier in the pod about fantastic landscapes and how Saudi Arabia showed off that country to its sort of best effect. And tour of Hellas, tour of Greece, is quite a mouthwatering prospect, chaps. I don't know if you agree.
Well, absolutely. Lizzie Banks of the Cycling Podcast and Team EF Tipco SVB, to give them their full name, she recently did a training camp in Greece and had a great time there. Said it was fantastic for training. So, yeah, it's not a place that you hear of riders going very often. Although a rider who I've just learned is retiring at the end of this year, Ilnur Zakarin, it seems like only yesterday we were calling him the next great prospect, but he's retiring at the end of the year. He did, or still does, live in Cyprus, doesn't he, Daniel?
I think he does, yeah.
All I can think of is that the World Tour calendar needs an olive oil swing. Just a succession of stage races in the olive oil heartlands.
I definitely put my name down for that.
There goes the Tour of Britain.
Thoughts on Cav, chaps? We heard Vassi there say that he shouldn't really be any weaker than last year. His numbers look just as good, or certainly in that ballpark. What do you expect from him over the next few months?
It's hard to know, isn't it? He's such a rider for the big occasion, isn't he? And you felt that at the Tour de France last year, it did feel a bit like the last hurrah. You know, Patrick Lefebvre even sort of hinted at that to you, Lionel, didn't he? That had he won on the Champs-Élysées, it would have been a great way for him to bow out. You know, it's a difficult situation in a way for him, because he's at the one team that he wants to be at, the one team at which he can probably still win at the highest level, or certainly have the best support around him to enable him to do so. But that also makes it more difficult to get that ticket to the Tour de France, which is, I'm sure, where he would really like to be. I mean, I'm sure he would love to go back to the Tour and, you know, have another go at continuing what he did last year and beating or becoming the outright holder of the record for stage wins at the Tour. I'm sure he'd love to do that. And he's being very diplomatic, isn't he? He doesn't have much choice. The pecking order seems quite decided. I mean, Michael Merku told us this at the Ghent 6, that as far as he was concerned, it was Fabio Jakobsen who'd be going to the Tour. And it would take something to happen to Jakobsen for that not to be the case, I think. And nobody would wish that. So Cavendish, I expect, will go to the Giro. But I have this question in my mind about how happy he is about that, really. I don't know.
Plenty of opportunities to win stages at the Giro. And as we saw last year, you just never know what might happen. I mean, again, without...
No, you don't.
Certainly not wanting to wish ill on Fabio Jakobsen for the sake of Mark Cavendish getting a ride in the Tour de France, of course. But all Cavendish can do is put the performances together, notch a few wins and just be there in case anything happens. And he might... You know, something might happen that means that he's the logical call-up for a place in the Quick-Step Tour de France team. You can't discount that possibility.
The other hypothesis that no one's really talked about, and I don't think Patrick Lefebvre really wants to contemplate, but it would be an option, would be to take them both. I mean, we saw Alpecin Phoenix last year with, two bona fide sprinters, and then also Van der Poel as well, who's able to sprint. And that is an option. But I remember before Skelderprijs last year, Lefebvre airing his misgivings about having two sprinters racing together, and Cavendish and Sam Bennett duly went to Skelderprijs, and it was a bit of a, well, they sort of fudged the finish. No one really knew, well, certainly it was difficult for Cavendish to know what his role should be in that situation. And I suppose Lefebvre would be concerned that that might happen again.
And I think, you know, Cav's not going to become lead-out man. They've got a very good lead-out man. And I think the problem in that scenario is actually potentially Jakobsen himself, because he is, you know, we saw this version of Jakobsen sort of emerge over the course of the Vuelta as his confidence returned. He became... never mind alpha vinyl, he was quite alpha male. And remember the day that Seneschal clipped off, he'd been dropped in the lead out. The lead out was just a bit too fast. He was distanced Jakobsen, and Seneschal went on to win the stage, and there were some harsh words exchanged at the finish. Jakobsen wasn't that impressed, he wasn't that pleased, so I can just imagine how he would feel with with another sprinter in the same team.
Well, again, he's the coming man, isn't he? He's never had that experience in the Tour de France, and he will feel his results deserve it. I can't see them taking both of them to the Tour de France. They'd need a second team bus or some kind of cooling down bus for whoever, you know, was having, was on the rough end of the team decision making each day. And I can't see that happening.
Just, I mean, before we go this week, I want to make you mentioned it earlier, Lionel, but the COVID cases in Valenciana, which knocked out, you know, a couple of teams. This is quite concerning. We also heard today that Pogacar had COVID last week. I mean, I wonder what's going to happen with this, because it seems that, COVID's not gone away. And the rules that are in place are still a kind of almost a zero tolerance policy of it, which is slowly not becoming the case in other aspects of life. And I just wonder whether sport and cycling will have to adapt their rules quite quickly, because otherwise, I think, and as we get into the major races, teams and major riders are going to be KO'd by COVID cases, either for themselves or within their teams. There are more cases than ever currently, and it's probably not sustainable to carry on forever with this approach whereby a COVID case on a team could potentially take the whole team out. Just thought I'd throw that out there. I mean, I don't know what the answer is, but I think we could see some changes to the rules before we get too much further into the season, perhaps.
Well, I think it will become a case of symptomless and asymptomatic, won't it? I mean, if somebody doesn't know that they've got the virus but aren't feeling perfectly well, in a situation where there's no testing required by the race, presumably no one will know. I mean, the UCI's protocol is clear. It differs for one-day races and for stage races. There'll be testing during the Grand Tours. So I would imagine that unless people are feeling unwell, it will be a case of continuing until a failed test on I'm assuming if the previous years are anything to go by, those tests will be on rest days. So certainly, yeah, it's not going to suddenly evaporate, this, is it? And it could wipe out some big name riders, but let's hope it doesn't. Before we go, just a quick corrections corner. Ronan Lee emailed with a comment about my piece about the world rankings last year. He pointed out that in 1989, when Sean Kelly's run as UCI world ranking number one rider came to an end, I'd said it was Laurent Fignon who toppled him. It was actually Charlie Motte, his French compatriot, who briefly topped the rankings in May 1989 before Laurent Fignon took over after winning the Giro d'Italia and finishing second in the Tour de France. And speaking of which, Richard, you set the question at the beginning, which you said we'd forget.
I did forget, yeah.
You did forget. The question was, has anyone posted a really impressive performance that hasn't resulted in a victory? And I was going to say Laurent Fignon in the 1989 Tour de France. I mean, he did almost everything but win the race, didn't he? He lost it by 8 seconds. But that
nobody remembers that race as being a great performance by Laurent Fignon, though, do they?
I think the days before, when he almost wrapped up the race, he almost put it out of Greg LeMond's reach with a couple of really impressive rides, I thought, you know,
Not having that. I think Bernardino, some of his best performances were in defeat in 86. There's more information on that in a book called Slaying the Badger. But he sort of almost became, well, he became a lot more popular in defeat than he ever was in victory. You know, the way that he went down endeared him to a lot of people and won him sort of admiration and awe. That's one that I can think of. I don't think I can think of any other great performances where the architect of the great performance has not won the race.
Well, listeners, write in if you can think of any. Thank you very much to Ronan for setting me straight on that, because getting something wrong about the 1989 season was pretty mortifying for me, because that would probably be my cycling specialist subject on Mastermind, I would have thought.
I mean, but having said what I just said, there are great performances by riders who are not supposed to win. Michael Morkov at the numerous stages of the Tour de France as a lead out man. Mark Renshaw going back a bit. There are numerous team performances. Anna van der Breggen at Liège Bastogne-Liège last year to help Demi Vollering.
I mean, what about Lance Armstrong, Tours de France, 1999 to 2005?
That's probably a candidate. Certainly, yep. Let's throw that one in the mix. Any others, Daniel?
there were a lot. That era was really a special era for
great performances that didn't result in a win.
Yeah.
No, absolutely. Loads of them. Take your pick. Just before we go, we've had a few emails as well from friends of the podcast wondering about their gifts for this year, because if you pay a little bit extra to be a friend of the podcast, you do receive a gift. Last year, it was a casquette and or a tea towel. We will be sending gifts again this year, doing something a little bit different this year. The tea towel is still available. But we'll be offering a couple of other things as well. And we'll be giving you details on that very, very soon in the next couple of weeks, I would think. So do stay tuned. But we haven't forgotten about you. And thank you very much, all of you who have signed up as a friend of the podcast.
We've got a few episodes from the archive coming later this week, releasing 4 conversations with some of the biggest figures in World Tour team management that we've made over the years, just adding them as a bonus, really, to the new Friends of the Podcast feed from the back catalogue, our lunches or coffees or get-togethers with Matt White, Patrick Lefevre, Dave Brailsford and Jonathan Vaughters. If you're a historic friend of the podcast, you may have heard them before, but if you're a new friend of the podcast, well, they may well be of interest to you, but we're adding them to the new feed on Friday.
And hopefully finishing them off with a current interview with a manager or recent manager from a World Tour team. So working on that one at the moment. But that's all for this week. We'll be back next week. And I think next week we'll be looking ahead to the UAE Tour and the first appearance of the season for Tadej Pogacar and other big names as well. Tom Dumoulin is down to ride there too. So we'll have lots to talk about next week. In the meantime, thank you very much, Lionel, and good luck with your Magical Mystery Tour.
Thank you, Richard.
Thank you, Daniel.
Thank you, chaps.
You've been listening to the Cycling Podcast with Lionel Burney, Daniel Freeb, and Richard Moore. To become a friend of the podcast or to sign up for our weekly newsletter, go to thecyclingpodcast.com. Our theme music is by Glass Pear, and this episode was produced by Hugh Owen.
Leagues Cup returns to Columbus. Your reigning Leagues Cup champion Columbus Crew are hosting 3 matches at Lower.com Field. Come out and watch the crew take on teams from Liga MX, Toluca, Puebla, and León starting July 29th. Grab your tickets now at ColumbusCrew.com and watch the best in North America battle to keep the trophy at home in Columbus. No ties, only wins. Major League Soccer versus Liga MX. Leagues Cup returns to Columbus, Ohio. Be there.